we're less focused on whether it's a broadly syndicated deal or whether it's a private credit transaction. And we're really more focused on putting in place a capital structure that allows for the company to have a capital structure where we can execute on our investment thesis.
Hello, and welcome to Cloud9Fin, a podcast on all things leveraged finance. We follow corporate debt from issuance to redemption, credits from performing to distressed, and everything in between. I'm Bianca Borber, and today I'm sitting down with David Leland, partner and head of capital markets at private equity fund BC Partners. The fund started in 1986 and has over 40 billion euros of assets under management across private equity, credit, and real estate in Europe and North America. David joined BC Partners in 2018, and before that, he was managing director at Citi, where he focused on leveraged finance originations. Thanks for coming on today, David.
Thanks for having me, Bianca.
So tell us more about your day-to-day role at BC Partners.
Sure. So in my role, I'm really responsible for all things capital structure for the portfolio companies. So everything from any debt, you know, at the inception of an investment, I'll work to put together the capital structure to support the acquisition, as well as, you know, throughout the lifetime of our ownership, work on refinancings, hedging, swaps, and then on exits. If it's an exit via an IPO, I'll work on the IPO and the follow-on monetizations as well.
Okay. And what is BC Partners' investment strategy?
We invest along four main verticals, so TMT, healthcare, industrials, and consumer retail. But I would say, you know, in this current fund, our 11th fund that we're invested in, you know, other than sort of pet and food ingredients, we probably would have a limited appetite for consumer retail.
And the rise in interest rates last year made it increasingly difficult for a lot of funds to refinance their upcoming debt maturities. Can you tell us how you dealt with refinancing the various credits under your portfolio last year?
Yeah, we try to take a very proactive approach to maturities. And so what we try to do is refinance early. And even in pockets of dislocation, there seems to be always windows of opportunity. And in certain instances, you know, we've used equity to delever our investments at the time of a refinancing, like we did on Vet Partners. You know, we've been supportive. Even we did the same for Innova in 2019 and for PetSmart in 2020. But, you know, we really just try to be very proactive and look across all the different various forms of capital in order to you know, proactively extend duration.
Okay, so this year we are seeing a significant rise in refinancing and repricing across the syndicated market. Tell us how that has affected some of your portfolio credits.
Yeah, I mean, you know, starting really towards the end of the fourth quarter last year, as the market started to see, you know, the peak rates environment and an expectation built in for declining interest rate environment over 2024. We started to see a lot of opportunity to both refinance and in certain instances reprice companies within the portfolio. And we got very active and progressive, starting with a very tight repricing of GFL in November 2023. We did a dividend recap for Navex, where we took out a syndicated loan in the private credit market with Portability. And then really to start the year in January, we've been fairly busy. We did a refinancing for Fedragoni, which was a financing that we had put in place to support our acquisition of the business in 2022. There, we were able to take out over 200 basis points of price on the floating rate note and extend duration by a year. We've also been very focused around duration. And so really over the last 5 months, really, since the end of the third quarter of 2023, we've refinanced almost $8 billion of maturities in the capital structure. And that's a capital structure that has around $40 billion of debt across it. So we've really taken advantage of the strength in the markets, which has been driven by an expectation of a continuation of rate decreases, as well as, you know, a view that, you know, wherever you are across Europe or the US, that we're either going to have some kind of soft landing or that we've gotten through the difficulties around inflation. And that, coupled with the lack of M&A supply, really the only way for investors to put capital to work is to be supportive of refinancings and repricings. And so, you know, United Group, we refinanced our 2025 and most of our 2026 maturities. We also repriced the 2029 maturity for United Group. And we've really attempted to be as proactive as possible at making sure that we have a significant amount of duration in the portfolio, as well as making sure that we optimize the portfolio for cost of capital.
We also saw a rise in private credit last year. Tell us how your portfolio companies have tapped this alternative source of funding in comparison to the traditional syndicated markets.
Yeah, I mean, we've been using private credit, you know, for at least 10 or so years. I mean, from our perspective, when we sit down and look at an investment, we really try to find a capital structure that's tailored to the investment thesis. So, you know, we have a number of private credit transactions or unitranche facilities across the portfolio. They tend to be very, very useful for businesses that you're going to use as a platform. And the reason for that is you have the readily committed acquisition facility that you can continuously borrow and draw down under as you're making tuck-in acquisitions across the investment. That being said, you know, we have a history of at the right time refinancing our private credit deals into syndicated loan market. And last year, we even refinanced one of our syndicated deals into the private credit market. So I think we're less focused on whether it's a broadly syndicated deal or whether it's a private credit transaction. And we're really more focused on putting in place a capital structure that allows for the company to have a capital structure where we can execute on our investment thesis.
So we've had a series of unprecedented events since COVID-19, which was then followed by the war in Ukraine. What are the various ways that you've supported your companies through this period?
Yeah, I mean, so a bunch of different ways. One, operationally. So we have a pretty hands-on strategy where we really try to partner with our teams and work on improving the operations of the team. You know, there have been selective instances where, you know, Italy as an example, where we had complete shutdowns across Italy and over COVID, which really negatively impacted some of the businesses, and those businesses we supported with equity.
And I guess in some cases, despite best efforts, some companies have had to go into restructuring. Last year, we saw a rising trend of creditors taking over companies through debt for equity swaps. As this has also been the case for some of the portfolio companies that you've managed, talk us through how this process has been for you.
Well, sometimes I'd say a little bit frustrating. And what I mean by that is that when it does come time where we can no longer be supportive of the business and it needs a transition or a change, at least our philosophy really is to try and do something as expeditiously as possible, especially for a business that's sales driven, right? Because we want to really, at that point, make sure that there's the least amount of disruption to the portfolio company, right? You're dealing with companies that have a large number of employees. You know, the quicker that you can execute on that handover or restructuring, probably the better it is for everybody in terms of maximizing value and maintaining value. And so I think when you're dealing with a restructuring in the syndicated markets, there are a lot of different parties, and each individual party might have their own limitations as to what they can or can't do, right? CLOs behave very differently than, say, a distress fund. You know, from our perspective, you know, what we're trying to do at that point in time, when it's no longer viable for us to own the business, is to really, as expeditiously as possible and as smoothly as possible, allow for that transition to happen.
Yeah. So let's talk about hold periods for PE funds. Given the dislocations we mentioned in the market, how have these affected how long BC Partners has kept hold of their companies?
You know, I would say, I don't know, average hold period for our investments are between 4 and 5 years. You know, when we go in, that's really what we're expecting. Certainly last year, with the lack of M&A activity, hold periods have been extended. That being said, you know, we had a fairly successful exit of a business of ours called EMA that we had held for around 2.5 years last year. And so I think it's company specific and industry specific. But it is true that the lack of capital formation and the disruptions particularly in the debt markets last year have extended hold periods slightly.
Mm-hmm. As we mentioned at the start of the podcast, BC Partners investments are across North America and Europe. What are some of the considerations you have to make when you are investing across these different jurisdictions?
So, you know, we invest 60% of our capital in Europe, right? We're a European fund that's focused on upper middle market investments within Europe. Within our investment, we have an ability to invest up to 40% of our capital outside of Europe, which we tend to do in North America. North America differs from Europe in the sense that, particularly the United States, because when I say North America, we do have investments in Canada as well as the U.S. In the United States, you have the Chapter 11 bankruptcy code, which is across all 50 states, and it's very uniform and platform. When you're dealing with a restructuring in Europe, each individual country has its own form of restructuring or its own rules that you have to navigate through to ensure that you can get to the best outcome.
What is your experience in dealing with these different regimes?
What we try to do in negative situations is come to a consensual agreement with creditors and really avoid the courts. And so for us, though, a majority of our debt in Europe is governed under English law, where you're other than getting 100% consent, you'd be subject to the UK code and to doing a scheme of arrangements. Now, I think it's probably in everybody's best interest, though, once you get to that 75% acceptance for everybody to vote yes, if they can. There are some complications around some CLOs that might be beyond their active life that can't vote. We've been fortunate to find structures that allow for 100% votes and doing things out of the courts. It saves time and money, which again, at the end of the day, is better for all constituents because it preserves more value for the business, and it's significantly lower in terms of legal fees. So we really are trying, if we get to that negative scenario, we're really trying to find a consensual route where we can do it outside of the courts.
That's all we've got time for this week. Thanks for joining us today, David.
Well, thank you for having me, Bianca.
And thanks to you, the listener, for tuning in. Please let us know if you have any feedback. You can reach out to us at any time by emailing team@ninefin.com, and check in next week to hear the latest on US markets with our colleagues in New York. And we'll be back the week after that. See you then.